From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're starting this hour with the latest from Syria, where Russian planes targeted ISIS fighters today, the latest bombings in a long conflict. But it's the base where those planes took off from that is surprising. They took off from Iran. It is the first time Russia has used another country to conduct military operations in Syria. Joining us from Moscow is NPR's Corey Flintoff. And Corey, what's the significance of this?
Well, Jeremy, the officials here in Russia are saying that it's just cheaper and more efficient for Russia to use bases in Iran. You know, up until now, a lot of these Russian long-range bombers have been flying all the way from bases in Russia. But I think the real significance here, though, is that it takes the military alliance between Russia and Iran to a new level, you know, allowing Russian warplanes to operate from Iranian soil. In a way, it mirrors the U.S. relationship with Turkey, you know, where American planes fly out of in Incirlik. It's a base in southern Turkey.
Well, what is the Russian goal in Syria right now? Because we remember that earlier this year in March, Russia said it was putting a stop to its military operations in Syria, which clearly has not happened.
Yeah, well, I think the goal of that announcement back in March may have been to assure the Russian public that this really was a short-term intervention and not the beginning of a quagmire in the Middle East. I think the political goal now for Russia is more or less the same. It's, you know, to establish Russia as a key player in the Syrian war, and it's to show that Russia can be an effective partner in the fight against Islamist terrorism. But ultimately, it's, you know, to change the sentiment in Europe and America so the West will drop its economic sanctions against Russia.
And those economic sanctions went into place because of what happened between Russia and Ukraine. I want to ask you about what's happening there now, because there's been a report of a rise in tensions between Russia and Ukraine. What's going on?
Well, as you know, there's been a steady increase in fighting in eastern Ukraine. That ceasefire has never really taken hold. And that's been documented by monitors from the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And on top of that, there's now a very tense situation in Crimea. Russia accuses Ukraine of sending saboteurs into Crimea. It says Ukrainian gunfire killed two Russian servicemen there. And President Putin has said that's something that will not go unanswered. The Ukrainians are saying that incident never happened. You know, but other people think Putin may have decided he can gain more advantage or more ground in Ukraine while the Western world is distracted, you know, by the vacation period in August and by the Olympics.
Funnily enough, some of us are actually still working in August. I guess the vacation period doesn't apply to everyone. Let me just ask you about one more thing, though, Corey, because the relationship with Russia has become a really central part of the presidential campaign here in this country. Just this week, with a new report about Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager, and what he had been doing in Ukraine for the former government of Yanukovych, which is a pro-Russian government. How is all this playing out in Russia about the relationship between Trump and Putin?
You know, I was talking to a Russian analyst just today, and he said the relationship isn't about Trump. It's about Hillary Clinton. He said Putin intensely dislikes Clinton. He believes that she was behind those anti-government demonstrations here back in 2011, 2012. And the thinking goes that Putin would like to see Clinton politically damaged, say, by revelations from those hacked DNC emails. That way, you know, even if Clinton is elected president, that damage could weaken her as far as foreign policy activities are concerned. On the other hand, if Trump is elected, you know, most analysts in Russia think he's somebody that Russia could do business with. But some people are actually worried that he could be quite an unpredictable partner.
But wanting Clinton to be damaged and actually going out and trying to damage her, which some people have alleged happened with the Russians actually going in and doing the hacking, what's the sense over there of what's actually going on?
Well, you know, as far as Russian public opinion is concerned and Russian state media are concerned, it never happened. You know, the Russian officials have denied it. They've sort of made fun of the allegation, although, in fact, you know, as we've seen in U.S. reports, there is a sort of a plausible chain of evidence that seems to connect all these dots. But it's very, very difficult. And in fact, the same analyst I was talking to today said it's very, very difficult to identify the source of these hacks and say that they're somehow orchestrated by the Kremlin. He personally thought that that was never going to happen because the evidence has been so well concealed.
That's NPR's Corey Flintoff joining us from Moscow. Corey, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Well, we want to take a closer look now at one slice of Donald Trump's foreign policy speech yesterday, in which he called for extreme vetting of immigrants coming to the U.S. and said the U.S. should return to a Cold War mindset in order to defeat ISIS. What does that mean, especially to people involved in immigration? Doris Meissner directs U.S. immigration policy work at the Migration Policy Institute. She's also former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton. And Doris, we're reading that immigration scholars at UC Davis and elsewhere are saying that even before Donald Trump mentioned the Cold War communist era, that's what they thought of when they heard about his proposal for extreme vetting. Now, lawmakers led by U.S. Senator Joe McCarthy were accused of witch hunting in the 50s and early 60s. What happened in immigration during the Cold War?
Well, the Cold War included laws passed in 1952 for immigration purposes that prohibited anybody coming to the United States from who supported a totalitarian regime or communism and therefore was assumed to advocate the overthrow of the United States. So that communist exclusion has been in our immigration law for a very long time. In fact, it is still there, but it has been modified significantly over time because it was very difficult to apply. And
why was it difficult to apply? Why couldn't
you? Well, for instance, there in the communist era, in the Cold War era, there were people who defected from the Soviet Union, who were fleeing persecution, and by the communist regime. But they were also in the Communist Party, and why were they? Because they had to be in the Communist Party in order to work in the country, or they were signed up involuntarily when they were children. And so in practice, it was difficult to implement.
So Donald Trump can point to precedent. There is precedent for someone, let's say, disavowing ISIS in this ideological test that he's proposing. Has there been that kind of a test before?
Not the kind of a test that Donald Trump is suggesting. And I think, you know, what he is suggesting presumes that somehow there isn't extensive vetting that goes on under the current way that the system operates. I mean, there is extensive vetting that goes on of people who come to the United States, particularly of groups like refugees from Syria, which seems to be a particular concern of his.
Well, let's just jump in to say that we aren't sure who he was talking about because he didn't distinguish between refugees who are fleeing and seeking asylum in the U.S. and immigrants who just want to come to the U.S. We've done reporting on refugees and the extensive vetting, that years of vetting sometimes, that happens before they come. But what about immigrants? What happens if you just want to be an immigrant to the U.S.?
Well, in order to be an immigrant to the U.S., you either have a close relative in the United States already who is sponsoring you to come, or you have an employer that wants to hire you in the United States. And so they answer an extensive set of questions, and they are put through an extensive set of criminal background checks and terrorism checks to determine whether they have, you know, should not be coming to the United States. Well, and one of the questions that they're asked explicitly, non-immigrants as well as immigrants, is whether they seek to engage in terrorist activities or have ever engaged in terrorist activities.
Well, you know, I hear that, Doris. I'm just going to stop you for a second because I can hear people saying, really? And you expect people to answer that truthfully?
Well, that would have been my next thing. Yeah. And do we expect that someone who's going to be a terrorist would tell us honestly? Of course not. So, you know, what can you expect really to achieve about questions on people's beliefs if, in fact, they're really intent on harming you?
In this ideological test, he said we should only admit to this country those who share our values and respect our people. And the values he named include gender equality and LGBT and gay rights. Now, of course, Hillary Clinton jumped right on that and pointed out that even his own vice president, and his nominee, Mike Pence, would not qualify to come into the U.S. on those grounds because he's passed anti-LGBT legislation in Indiana. But can you ask people that they would uphold things like gay rights in the U.S.?
Well, you certainly can ask people that, particularly in immigration circumstances. You have broad leeway to ask and create the conditions that you think are valid. But those are highly subjective questions, and what relationship they bear to any likelihood of future terrorist intentions or actions is completely unclear.
Doris Meissner, director of the U.S. Immigration Program at the Migration Policy Institute. We'll have to continue on this topic at another time. It's fascinating. Doris, thank you.
Thank you.
We talked yesterday about infrastructure in this country, but listen to what's happening in London. This week, the London Underground expands its coverage in some parts of the city to 24 hours a day on Fridays and Saturdays, known as the Night Tube. And an even bigger advancement is around the corner, a new rail line that spans the width of the city and beyond, including a direct connection to Heathrow Airport. A section of the Crossrail project is set to open next May, with a longer route working by December 2018. Once in operation, it'll include 26 miles of new tunnels and will be known as the Elizabeth Line, named after Her Majesty. It will serve around 200 million people each year. Howard Smith is the operations director of the Elizabeth Line. He joins us from London. Welcome, and tell us about Crossrail. What's the plan?
Well, the plan is to join up railways either side of London. If you go back historically in London, nearly 150 years ago, the government prevented railways being built across the middle of London. So as some of your listeners will be familiar, in the UK and many European cities, you have to take a big train to the edge of town, and then you get off and you go down onto the underground or the metro. Crossrail is about bridging that gap, if you like, building a railway that runs out from either side of London, east and west, but you stay on the train and it takes you through a tunnel 21 kilometres long right through the heart of London, through Canary Wharf, through the city, through the West End, connecting into places like Heathrow. So that's what Crossrail's about.
And I imagine it would have been a lot easier to build something like this through the centre of London 150 years ago compared to now. How are you able to get this done now with all of the other tunnels that are underground, with all of the buildings that are on the ground?
Well, that's a really good and interesting question. 150 years ago, they wouldn't have known how to build a tunnel that long, that deep under London. But obviously, after that came the tube network. Crossrail is being built across London from east to west. Most of it goes beneath the existing underground lines, but not very far beneath them. So at the closest, at Tottenham Court Road, the Crossrail tunnels are only about 60 centimetres, 2 feet away from the existing Northern Line. So building 21 kilometres of dual-track tunnel through the middle of London, quite a challenge, and one that the engineers have risen to absolutely superbly.
How are you able to do it so quickly? I was in London and I saw a sign on the side of the road that said Crossrail coming, building now 100 meters per week, which sounded just unbelievable. And I think about what's happening in New York. There's the Second Avenue subway line is expected to open early next year, but it is one section that is not nearly as long as the Crossrail is. And also, it's been going on for years.
Well, Crossrail had quite a long gestation period. There have been plans for Crossrail for decades, but once we got going with construction, once we got the go-ahead, got the funding together, really the speed of the job is about breaking it down into manageable chunks. So the tunnelling was done with 10 tunnel drives, so 8 tunnel boring machines working pretty well at the same time. It's not one machine making its way the whole way across London. It's about breaking it down, stations being built at the same time. And then obviously when you start laying track, put in power supplies, things like that, that's when the railway gets joined up and comes together as a whole. But basically breaking the job down is the way to building it in a reasonable period of time.
How does it affect the people who are living above it?
These days, tunneling is a very, very refined art. Even I remember tunneling being for people who were the real maths whizzes who could work out how you made sure that the tunnel ended up in the right place. These days, it's still very clever stuff, let's be clear, but it's done with things like lasers and computers. So actually, the amount of settlement and the amount of deviation you get from the plan is very, very small. So as you'll have hopefully spotted when you were in London, the effects of Crossrail on the surface, where there's not actually a hole, a building site, underground, the tunnelling has been pretty well flawless and almost nobody has been affected.
And is there ever a moment in the course of making something like this that somebody above ground says, I'm going to sue you to stop the construction here because I don't want you to do this right underneath my property? Do you deal with lawsuits?
Not really, because the process for getting big projects built in the UK is generally via what's called a hybrid bill. So you put a bill through Parliament that's backed by government that says this gives you the right to build the railway. Obviously, there are protections for people, there are compensation schemes, but once the government has given the go-ahead to a railway, then you're ready to build. So that's why we've been able to build it pretty quickly, successfully so far, and we look forward to opening it across the centre of London in December 2018, the timescale we've always set.
How much is this going to cost?
The budget for Crossrail, sometimes term it the funding envelope, is around £15 billion sterling.
That's it? The whole thing?
That's it, the whole thing.
Wow. And do you face any pushback from taxpayers, from people who say we shouldn't be spending this money on that, let's spend it on this instead?
Generally in London, Crossrail Future Elizabeth Line, we had a visit from the Queen earlier this year and she announced that when we open the tunnel it will be called the Elizabeth Line, so that's how we'd refer to it in the future. Generally speaking, it's very, very popular. People appreciate the fact it'll give you a better, quicker journey. They appreciate the fact that it'll actually add capacity to the centre of London, because again, for anybody who's visited London, you'll be aware that the tube network is quite full, and actually additional capacity through the centre of London is very welcome. And also, many people appreciate the fact that it adds to property values. So where you're living in the suburbs now, if you have a Crossrail station near you, you may well see an appreciation in property values. Certainly in the centre of town, commercial developers have seen substantial benefits and they have to pay something out of that towards the new line.
And I have to ask this question for our listeners who probably, if they're going to London, they're going to need to know this part of it. How long will it take to get from Heathrow to the centre of London?
About half an hour, depending on where you're going. It'll take about 22 minutes from Heathrow into Paddington, so to the west of London. And then depending on where you're going on to, as I say, about half an hour, plus or minus 5 minutes, depending on where you're actually heading for in the centre of London. So very quick. And obviously at the centre of town, Crossrail will be running at up to 24 trains an hour in the peak. So that's a train every 2.5 minutes.
And these trains will look somewhat different than the trains that we would ordinarily ride on the tube right now.
Trains will be bigger because Crossrail is essentially a full-size national rail, heavy rail as you might call it, railway brought underground. So it'll draw power from an overhead wire, as opposed to from the third rail system. The trains will be in very, very long. They'll be about twice as long as a current tube train. They'll be 200 metres long. You can fit about 1,500 people or possibly a few more into one of those trains. So a very different train. Air conditioning. Some of London's lines already have air conditioning, but Crossrail will be an enormous boost to that. Stations will be accessible from street to platform, so there'll be lifts for people who need assistance, don't find it easy to use things like stairs and escalators. So big benefit in terms of passenger movement in London.
What has been the biggest challenge for you in making this happen?
I think if we look at the project as a whole, you could probably say there's three levels of challenge. The first challenge is actually to get the project away. I've been involved for over 10 years now, and actually getting to the point where government gives you the powers and gives you the permission and the funding to build the project. That in itself is quite a challenge. Then there's the projects, the challenges that have been faced, hundreds, thousands of them, by engineers to actually build the line, and that's what we're getting on with at the moment. And then once you actually finish the line, as operations director, I've got another challenge coming up because I've got to make it work from end to end. So running off an existing railway into a tunnel through the middle of London and out of the other side. So that in a project this big, there's a whole series of challenges, both geographically and also in terms of time.
One more thing I want to ask you, Howard Smith, and I promise I won't tell anybody what you say in the answer, but how do you think that the London Tube and your underground and your overground compare to the system in New York?
Oh, my goodness. I couldn't possibly tell you that even in private. What I would say is that I enjoyed enormously traveling around on the New York system. I mean, I'm very, very proud of London. Proud of the system that we've got at the moment, proud of what Crossrails and Elizabeth Line is going to be. I was also here during the Games, the 2012 Games in London, which was probably, you know, one of our finest hours here. Over in New York, I've seen huge improvements. I'm old enough to have been to New York in the 1980s when the system perhaps wasn't so shiny. And actually, when I spent a week in New York recently, we just travelled around from end to end by subway with the family, and it was great, and it works.
That's Howard Smith, who is the operations director of the Elizabeth Line, which is set to open in 2018 in London. Howard, thank you.
Thank you.
Please remember to keep all your personal belongings with you at all times. This is a Piccadilly Line service to Heathrow Terminals 1, 2, 3, and 5.
The sounds of London on Here and Now.
And while the bourbon state is not yet ready to call itself the hops state, farmers want to cash in. Roxanne Scott of Here Now contributor Louisville Public Radio reports.
Leah Dinas knows beer.
So what I've done is I've added hot water to the grain. And this is one of our recipes, but it's mostly two-row barley. Kind of tastes like granola.
She's one of the partners and the head brewer at Apocalypse Brew Works in Louisville. Her great-great uncles were brewers in the city too, but that's not why she got into brewing.
This is a hobby just gone totally out of control.
Apocalypse's beer is made in Louisville, and some of the grain is sourced locally. But when it comes to hops, Dina says she has to import them from other parts of the country or world.
We use some from New Zealand. They're a big hop producer. And then the West Coast is mainly the West Coast is what's producing. That's where we're getting a lot of them from, like Yakima Valley.
That's Yakima Valley in Washington. The Pacific Northwest is responsible for more than 90% of hops production in the U.S. The 28 breweries in Kentucky mostly buy the hops they need from states out west like Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. There aren't many options yet for breweries who want to buy local. It's a clear Saturday morning on a farm just east of Lexington. Members of the Kentucky Hop Growers Alliance are sitting in a circle outside, having their monthly meeting to chat about, well, hops.
Oh, this is our usual meeting. Wait till we have two more beers. Oh, that's right. Nobody's called for a beer break.
Jokes aside, it's a chance for hop growers to air their concerns and to talk about what growth they may see in Kentucky's hop industry.
I'm cautiously optimistic.
Sean Wright is a horticulturist at the University of Kentucky. And he knows hops.
Well, there's certainly a good market for locally produced hops. The big question is going to be the economics of it. We have challenges here in Kentucky that some of our growers in the Pacific Northwest don't have to deal with. We have more disease pressure and things.
Hops is native to Kentucky. The eastern U.S., including Kentucky, used to be a huge producer until an outbreak of downy mildew affected production in the early 20th century. Right now, there are about 20 acres of commercial hops yards in the Commonwealth. In the state of Washington, there are more than 32,000 acres. But there's no reason Kentucky can't eventually compare itself to the West, say attendees at the Hop Growers Alliance. Pete Lonnie drove an hour and a half to attend the meeting. He's considering getting into the hop production business.
I think there's definitely a lot of room to grow. Everybody's got to go through the growing pains. It's definitely an industry that can grow with the way the craft brewing industry is growing out of control.
There are 4 to 6 new breweries opening in the state this year. That number is expected to grow, and local hop growers want to cash in.
I just got an email from someone in Kentucky.
Leah Dina says there's a chance Apocalypse Brewworks could be buying locally sourced hops soon.
They want to meet and see what kind of hops, if we'd be interested. We use all the hops that they're growing, which is a plus.
Kentucky has a long way to go before it can be a major supplier of the state's breweries. But Dina's and others have good reason to be optimistic. For Here and Now, I'm Roxanne Scott in Louisville, Kentucky.
According to the Department of Justice, in 2013, only 35% of sexual assault victims reported their claims to the police, which is what makes sex assault cases so hard to investigate. Carrie Hull was a beat cop in Ashland, Oregon. When she became a detective a few years ago, she asked for a chance to fix the problem and was told, go ahead. She created a program that gives victims reporting options, and she's now traveling to other police departments who either have or want to implement the program. She's with us in Boston. And so, Carrie, Detective Hull, how did you start?
What I did is I started talking directly to the victims that were experiencing this crime and started asking them, what would you like the police to do for you? Yeah. What is the reason that you don't feel like you're able to stay with the process ultimately for us to be able to move forward with a case? Or what is keeping you from coming in and reporting it in the first place to law enforcement?
And what was the overarching answer?
Oh, we received, and I will say pretty consistently, actually, three responses. They're concerned with their confidentiality. And when you report to law enforcement, you have public records laws, you have a report that's taken, this incredibly personal thing has happened to you where you've been violated, and we document it, and we document it a lot of times, especially if it goes to trial, where it becomes a public record for people to read about. And so confidentiality every single time, but also they do have at some level of fear that they're not going to be believed. That isn't always just from law enforcement, though. We heard when we really started talking with people that it was a fear that their families weren't going to believe them. It was a fear that the social network that they were involved with was going to judge them or not believe that this had occurred. What we know about, you know, people who offend is that oftentimes they know the person they victimized. So very understandable that this could be a family member. This could be somebody that they've been friends with for 10 plus years, even 6 months. So that means this person is also going to know other people in their life. And it is hard.
What's the third reason?
That they delayed reporting. So they were concerned that because they didn't initially report right after it occurred, that they weren't going to be believed.
Right. So you've come up with this new program called You've Got Options. What are the options?
There is a series of 20 elements to the program. There may be a victim that steps forward that wants two or three of those. We don't put what we believe someone needs on the person who was victimized. We let them tell us what they need. And that's a real shift from the traditional law enforcement response, which can be pretty assumptive of what somebody needs or wants or should want if they've been victimized.
Well, for instance, if someone is the victim of a crime, they can sleep on it and decide whether or not they want to come in and talk.
Yeah, and that's true of any person who's victimized. The reality is, it is a volunteer system. There's no requirement that you have to report to the police. Traditionally in law enforcement, we've been fairly heavy-handed with statements. And again, not every police department, but the assumption about law enforcement is that we expect people to just come forward and tell us everything that happened. And when someone doesn't, you sort of hear a response both from society and sometimes law enforcement, well, why didn't they? It's a volunteer system.
It's interesting. I was reading about how the Brighton Police Department in Colorado, which is one of your partners that has taken this up, one of those officers said, well, wait a second. We give police officers after a shooting. We tell them to go away and think about it so they can have more clarity. You're nodding. Why not give victims of assault the same option? They also can remain anonymous. But you know what happens when that happens? The people who are the accused say, well, wait a second. Well, how come my name is out and the person who accuses me gets to remain anonymous?
Yeah, and it's an understandable concern. We're using law enforcement methods that are used in all sorts of other areas of crime. So, for instance, drug offenses. We encourage anonymous reporting of drug offenses all the time. We actually work confidential, reliable informants where we even pay people for intelligence on offenders who are drug offenses because it's intelligence. Now, that does not mean in any way that somebody is labeled as a suspect when we don't have corroboration that a crime has occurred. It does mean that we have more information that could lead to that corroboration at a later date.
A couple of the other elements that people can choose to use, they can control the location, the time, the date when they make a report to law enforcement. They can bring an advocate with them, somebody maybe from a sexual assault organization. the premise is that reporting is so low because of these other issues. Now, usually, police departments like to keep reporting and rates low. You're shaking your head no. Because if you are encouraging reporting and you are and you're getting results, which I understand you are, you're getting more reporting, you're driving your crime rate up.
Well, the crimes are already happening. So it's not that you have more crimes happening in your community. You just have more intelligence potentially on offenders that are committing that crime. So you have to be very, very careful about what correlations you draw to low crime report numbers. Mm. That doesn't mean the crime is not happening. You should be very, very proud as a member of your community if you have a high rate of reporting regarding sexual assault for law enforcement, because it means that they're doing something to provide an environment where survivors feel like they can step forward and provide information.
You mentioned that much of sexual assault is a known attacker, known victim. But I've also been reading that it's also a repeat offender. Mm-hmm. So if you drive the rates up by getting more reporting, you stand a better chance of finding those people and charging them and driving the rates back down.
Exactly. We definitely hope over time that we will see a reduction in victimization. Our goal initially is to increase the reporting. But, we have other goals in the program. We really seek for victims to view law enforcement as a viable route to justice. We don't want them to feel like they can't come forward and interact with the criminal justice system, because it is to our benefit to gather that intelligence. It's also to our benefit to make sure that they receive services. Mm-hmm. You can actually make somebody more vulnerable if you increase the likelihood that they won't report to police. If mm-hmm. you think about it just from an offender's perspective, if you're going to pick someone to victimize, is it better to pick somebody who feels like they can come forward and talk with the police something happens to them? Or is it better to target somebody who would never report to the police?
Because they have shame.
Yes.
Yeah, and all the reasons we mentioned. I'm wondering, Carrie, Detective Hull, how does this dovetail with something else that we found out from the scathing look at the Baltimore police system, in which they found a dysfunctional relationship between the police and the black community? Mm-hmm. They also were scathing in how the Baltimore Police Department treated women, the names that women were called by police when they didn't think anyone was hearing. Look, we don't want to broad brush here. We don't want to paint all police with this, but yeah. Does this tell you that you're onto something, that there is a problem systematically in some police departments about the way women victims are viewed?
Oh, we absolutely know that there's a problem. I wish that this program wasn't necessary. And let me be clear, I adore my profession. We have an amazing amount of people that are in law enforcement to do the right thing. None of us in law enforcement are okay with somebody who is, wearing the uniform standing next to us not doing the right thing. And mm-hmm. that's why we take it so, so incredibly careful when we accept police departments into this program. You can't just say that you want to be a You Have Options agency and we, give you a logo and you put a brochure out in your police department. It holds a very high level of accountability, because we do not want to let other police departments who may not be in a place that they have identified that gender bias, where they have identified that need for training, if they're not to that place, they're not going to dilute the program for other police departments that have yeah. really put in the time to do this right. We hope over time what that means, because it is law enforcement led, and that's what's particularly unique here. This is from within our profession, from law enforcement officers, talking to other law enforcement officers saying this is possible, we can do this, and it works. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the agencies that join, so you have the Brighton Police Department, you have the Garfield County Sheriff's Office in Washington. When you have these agencies who fully have implemented, they have opened themselves up to accountability within their communities. So this isn't something that you can just say you're doing and then have a survivor walk into your police department and not have this response. It actually requires that there is a written policy that every officer will offer these options equally. And that's wonderful for survivors.
Just to tell us quickly, how much has your rate of sexual assaults gone up in Ashland after implementing this program?
So initially, when we started in 2013, we saw that first year, and we did not anticipate this by any means, 106% increase in reporting that first year. We've consistently had the same number come in.
And again, 106% increase yeah. in reports of sexual assault. That's a good thing.
Not only are we seeing consistency where we hear back from survivors that they don't regret reporting to police, which is incredible, we're also hearing from police officers that they don't feel as upset, as frustrated by investigating these cases, because by providing options, they're allowing people to interact with the criminal justice system more in the way that's right for them, so that they actually continue yeah. to yeah. stay involved.
Carrie Hull, a detective at the Ashland Police Department and director and founder of the You Have Options program, which she's taking around the country. We'll have more at hereandnow.org. Detective Hull, Carrie, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, Carrie also told us that, yes, a fraction of sexual assault report claims are false, but better reporting and investigation should make the falsely accused feel better about the process as well.
After 14 years, the independent journalism of Gawker will soon be no more. The news outlet plans to sell in an auction that began today, and it appears that the new owner will either be the media company Ziff Davis or Univision. In June, Gawker filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection after a $140 million legal judgment from an invasion of privacy lawsuit by former wrestler Hulk Hogan, a.k.a. Terry Bollea, that was funded by billionaire Peter Thiel. For more, we're joined by our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
So the names that we do know that are bidding for Gawker are, as we said, Ziff Davis and Univision. What are they offering? Do we know?
We don't know the exact price yet. We do know that Ziff Davis, however, their initial bid, or what's called the stalking horse bid, was for $90 million. If someone else comes in this case it's really just Univision, it's got to be that or higher, certainly. You know, and then we've got a bit of a race, right? That's what today is about, is that between these two, they've just got to outbid each other.
And do we have a sense of what either would do with Gawker? Would it remain what it is?
It's certainly going to be different. It's not entirely clear, what the longer term aims are with these properties. In either case, however, whether it is Univision or Ziff Davis, the Gawker we tend to know, that's more well known, will certainly not be anymore. I think Gawker.com, the flagship site or the namesake site, will either just sort of operate in a different way or even maybe eventually go to a different owner, because right now it doesn't seem like either side really wants that particular property. It's the other property, the sister properties like Jezebel or Jalopnik or Gizmodo, which is a tech site that they're more interested in.
And would the new owner have to pick up the tab for that $140 million lawsuit?
No. So that's what's interesting here, is that the bankruptcy filing, the way that Nick Denton, the CEO and the current owner of Gawker, the way they did their filing is that they did it in such a way that they can sort of cordon off the so-called toxic assets, right? Namely, this $140 million liability from the good assets, the rest of the sites that, are still money-making sites. So that way, whether it's Ziff Davis or Univision, they're just buying the good side of it and not liable for the $140 million judgment.
Now, I want to talk about Peter Thiel, who funded the lawsuit on behalf of Terry Bollea, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan, against Gawker. But before we get to that, if you could just give us the brief version of what happened there, because that's an interesting story all by itself, and I think it'll help listeners understand what we're going to talk about next.
Right. So Peter Thiel's an interesting character. He's a billionaire venture capitalist, and he's one of the early backers of Facebook, and he sits on Facebook's board, and that's his sort of big win, his big claim to fame in Silicon Valley. He's a libertarian at heart, and the reason why he got into this is that Gawker outed him. They wrote a post years ago that effectively outed Peter Thiel as gay. He didn't like it. He felt it was an invasion of privacy. What's interesting, though, is that he actually didn't file a lawsuit on his own behalf. What he ended up doing instead was he found other claimants, other plaintiffs, in this case Hulk Hogan, and he helped fund their cases against Gawker in an effort to essentially take them down. And he's effectively succeeded.
And he had an op-ed in the New York Times today about the future of journalism. What did he say?
Well, it's interesting. He was basically saying it was kind of a victory lap in terms of this whole Gawker case, but he was also saying that, it's important to maintain privacy, and in order to do that, we need to push back against the Gawkers of the world. At the same time, what he said in his op-ed is that it wasn't his role to draw the line. It's up to journalists to decide what is and isn't fair. The thing is, he's exactly done that. He's created a mechanism by which he's determining what counts as good journalism and what doesn't by funding these cases. And I think that's a slippery slope. That's dangerous. I mean, it's fine for him to feel that his privacy invaded and file a lawsuit. Instead, he's sort of setting up a referendum about journalism itself. And I think that's dangerous.
What do you think the lasting legacy of all of this news about Gawker and Peter Thiel and Hulk Hogan? What is the legacy for journalism?
So I think Gawker is a divisive
you know, in a lot of ways was a divisive entity, right? Even amongst journalists. There are a lot of journalists, friends of mine, who hate what they've done and the way they've done. Others think that they've done actually a pretty good job and really expanded the bounds, the envelope, so to speak, of what is and isn't journalism. I think what the lasting effect, however, with the Thiel and this lawsuit is it'll just chill that experiment, right? With the, you know, digital media offered Gawker and all these other sites the ability to try to sort of test the boundaries of what journalism can and can't be. And I think, you know, these lawsuits are effectively chilling, you know, any attempt to try something different, something new. And I think that's the bigger loss here, not necessarily that Gawker itself isn't all around, but that sort of the willingness to try that, you know, will be tamped down.
Do we know if Gawker's traffic has gone down since all this happened or gone up?
It's actually gone up. It's gone up quite a bit, in fact. And as I said, it's still a profitable company. You know, it has lots of readers. It sells advertising and it turns a profit, which a lot of Silicon Valley startups don't have.
Any press is good press. Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode, thank you so much as always.
Anytime.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.